Hey there, you're listening to High Performance, our gift to you for free every single week. This is the chart-topping podcast that turns the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. So today, along with tens of millions of others, allow the greatest leaders, thinkers, sports stars, entertainers and entrepreneurs to be your teacher. You know, I was reading a book this week by a guy called Greg Hoffman, who was the former chief marketing officer of Nike, and he will be on the podcast very soon. We're recording with him in a couple of weeks. I'm very excited. I don't think the book's available yet. It's yet to be released. But there was a great quote in there. See what others see, but find what others don't. And it just stood out to me. I thought you'd like it. See what others see, find what others don't. And the reason why I like that line is because I think it's all to do with empathy. It's all to do with a better understanding of our fellow human beings. And once you understand them better, you can go deeper. I'm talking about a deeper understanding of them, of course, but also deeper relationships, deeper compassion, the ability to be an ally in a much deeper way. And that's really what I want today's episode to offer you, an opportunity to get a deeper understanding of a man currently doing one of the most impressive jobs in the Premier League this season. In the next hour, we're joined by a Premier League manager, but we don't talk about formations. We go deeper than that. We go deeper than league position. We go deeper than football results. For the next hour, we talk all about life. And we do it with one of the most experienced managers working in English football today. This is the High Performance Podcast with the West Ham manager, David Moyes.
I see leadership come in lots of different forms. I don't think leadership is one way you do leadership. I think everybody does their own type of leadership. And mine was to sort of probably dig the players out right away. Every game in this business is a hard one to win, you know, and you can hardly smile because you've got another difficult game round the corner. But I just changed my mind and said, I'm going to be positive, I'm going to pass it on to the players, and we're going to try and be attractive as much as we can. We're going to try and get to a stage where we're a much more attractive looking team. And there's a lot of opinions out there, you know, the industry, the world, these situations means there's a lot of opinions. I think you have to try and do it with a bit of humility. You're trying to tell people how things are, you know, but I'm not trying to tell them this is the way, but somewhere along the line, you have to be the person who makes the decision.
David had so much to tell us, and it was so interesting to have this kind of conversation. So what I want you to do today is just suspend your opinion, because you may well have an opinion when you click on this podcast about how David transformed Everton. I know many former and current Manchester United players listen to this podcast. They too would have to put aside their opinion of his time at Old Trafford. You Man United fans tuning in will have to do the same. The same for Sunderland or Real Sociedad fans. And even, despite the fact he's doing an absolutely stunning job at West Ham, even the Hammers fans that have a preconception of who and what David Moyes is have to put that to one side. So at the time of this record, West Ham are chasing European football. They're in the Europa League quarterfinals in the coming days. We wish David and the team the very best of luck with that. He has reignited the relationship between his players and the fans at West Ham. So how's he done it? What are his challenges? How did his upbringing inform his work? It's very rare to hear top-flight managers talking in this way. Yet if you like it, there's more from High Performance. You can find episodes with Maurizio Pochettino, Frank Lampard, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Steven Gerrard, Steve Clark, and so many more. So welcome along. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the High Performance Podcast. As always, I'm joined by Professor Damien Hughes, an expert in high-performing team cultures who has worked for so many years with all kinds of teams in all different spheres. So I really hope you enjoy the unfiltered truth today from High Performance. I think you're going to love it. David Moyes on High Performance comes next.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
We always start with the same question on this podcast. What is high performance to you?
Very simply, teamwork for me. But teamwork comes a lot of different aspects, but simple answer, teamwork.
So what does teamwork represent to you?
Teamwork represents accountability from everybody included. An inclusivity, if I get the word right there, would be something which I try to have with my staff, that they're very much part of it. I think that everybody buying into what we do, a lot of trust is required, because I want my staff to be part of that journey, what I would hopefully go on wherever I may be. So that's a couple of thoughts on it, but I think teamwork really generally would be where I would start.
Which is a fascinating answer, because looking at your background, David, I was really taken by the role of your dad when he was the amateur coach at Drumchapel.
Yeah.
And I was interested in how many of those values, and I imagine teamwork was one of them, that you experienced growing up that you still take with you today at West Ham.
Well, I had a really good background, if you want to call, for football management, because my dad did run one of the teams, which is a club called Drumchapel Amateurs in Glasgow, and like Sir Alex played there, and many, many great sort of Scottish players played for them. John Wark, and I can think Asa Hartford and people like that in the early days all played there. So as a young boy, I used to go and watch the team. I watched my dad organise the games, the pitches, the referees, you know, take the team. And then he would come back with the strips, and my mum had to wash the strips, you know, and they would be hung out in the back garden, and it'd be my job to fold them up. So from an early age, there was a wee bit of organisation and probably a wee bit of leadership getting looked at right from the start, watching how my dad done it. But they were great days, and I used to go and watch them and follow the team everywhere they went, really.
And if your dad was watching you now, what common characteristics would he see that he'd be able to trace back to those days?
I think the values which was set in, you know, like things like discipline and turning up. I mean, in those days, Drumchapel Amateurs, the players had to turn up with shirts and ties on. You know, and they wouldn't have played them if they didn't turn up with shirts and ties on, you know. And now, look at the state of us. You know, I'm coming to do this and no collar and tie on. But in those days, you know, there was a lot of discipline. I think discipline is still a big, big part of any industry, but certainly a football club, it's really, really important.
I'm really interested to know how you get those values into a modern football club. You know, you've been a manager for a long time. Mm-hmm. The game feels like it's changed. Players feel like they've changed. But you are as successful, if not more successful now than you've ever been. So what is the secret to making a modern football club gel, which is what you've achieved at West Ham?
Well, I think we need everybody on the same page. But commitment, I think, is one. I think everybody needs to be committed and going to help you. And you don't need it broken. And let's be fair, you know, if you're talking about West Ham in general, for many years it's looked that way. I've found it really good to work with. I've found that everybody's pulled together, all going in the same direction. But sometimes you need good bits of fortune, you need bits of luck. I always remember, even when I first got my job at Everton, I remember Walter Smith saying to me, he says, "You're going to be really lucky." And I'd taken over from Walter. He says, "There's a young boy in the academy." He says, "He's going to be a great player." And you think, "Oh, never see him in my time." And it happened to be Wayne Rooney. And things like that actually can help you personally, can help the club, gives the club more profile. We're a little bit like that at West Ham at the moment. You know, we've got Declan Rice, who's an outstanding English international, and he's helping the club in helping us all at the moment. And I think trying to make West Ham, I'm going to say more popular, but certainly I think West Ham have become a club with team that people actually quite like watching because they've seen a lot of good things in the last year or two.
So when you say commitment, what does that look like?
I think the commitment for me is that the players are going to be part of that as well. You know, I mentioned the staff, I think the staff, but I need the players to buy into how we work, what we try and do. And sometimes that's not easy. This was my second time at West Ham. I'd been there before and actually felt we had done enough to retain the job the first time. But we didn't. So coming back, you know, I had to think deeply, was I going to get the players on my side? But by all accounts, you know, the players were really keen on me coming back. And that gave me a start. And I think sometimes, as I said, you need a little bit of help and things to go well for you, for it to work. I think we see lots of clubs which are not committed behind their managers or their coaches. And I think they're the clubs which tend to find that, you know, things don't go well.
So we have lots of non-football people that listen to this.
Yes.
Lots of business leaders, lots of teachers. And they're all doing a very similar job to you, really. They're getting a group of people and trying to get them to believe in a common aim. So let's take this most recent iteration of West Ham for you. When you went back in, do you remember what the sort of first thing you did or said to the players was, which may well give people outside of the game an indication of what they can do with their teams to get people on side?
I had told them that I'd watched the games and I thought that they hadn't performed well. I had the video of the games, I'd watched a few of the games, and I showed them and I said, this is nothing like we're going to play and this is nothing like you will be acceptable. There was lots of incidents where players weren't running back, players were out of position, and that's no criticism of any other manager or any other coach. So that was the way I decided to go. But I think that the leadership I took, or the way I saw that being then, was that this was the way I wanted it to be done. I had to do it really quickly. We'd short amount of games or we could have been relegated. What was going to happen? And also, I was coming back from a situation where, you know, people were probably saying, oh, David Moyes coming back, not too sure about that. No, how's he going to react? And, you know, he's been here before, and maybe some people were seeing there's been some jobs that haven't worked for me. So I had that to deal with as well. But I decided if I was going to go, I had to go full on. And I see leadership coming in lots of different forms. I don't think leadership is one way you do leadership. I think everybody does their own type of leadership. And mine was to sort of probably dig the players out right away. There's things I could look at. You know, we were, for example, physically, West Ham were really poor in the physical stats. And I think when you're not doing well, you want to think that your supporters want to think that their players are committed, they're working hard, they're doing everything they can, they're committed. And then when you look and say, well, actually, you know, you're bottom of the physical stats for distance ran, you know, you don't make many sprints, you know, all those things that go with it. So in many ways, for a coach or a manager, these can be quick wins.
Yeah.
But you still have to try and get the players to do it.
And what did you also do to provide some sort of psychological safety to those players? Because I can see that going in and going, not good, not good, not good, do this better. They understand the levels you want to operate at. But then comes the moment where you need to bring them on side, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you go about letting them know that's not good enough, but then comes the arm around the shoulder, if you like?
Well, the practice and the compliments and the encouragement. And I think I felt practices which would make them feel good. And strangely enough, players running hard and getting cheered. And I make a sort of, I'll tell you this a little bit, 2 years ago, for the people who do understand football, was we had Marko Arnautović at West Ham, who was not particularly liked by the supporters, didn't do well. I remember saying to Marco, I says, it's strange football, you know, if you run around and you close down and you chase people, the supporters cheer you. And I used to always say, if I was a centre forward, all I would do was run hard and make the supporters think, because I'd get a cheer, they'd be pleased with me. And really, all players want to be acknowledged and want to be, you know, think that they're doing a good job. Marco started running, chasing people down, started to win a few balls back and got the plaudits for it. Also, he had the technical ability. So that is one of the examples where I think actually, you know, sometimes to make it simple and say, well, why don't you just run a bit harder? Why don't you try and show people that you do care, you are committed? And I think that was probably the level we started. And it was probably There's nothing clever about it, but it was a base level where I felt if we started there, then we could see where we could go.
See, there's a phrase that you use there, David, that really fascinates as well, that you spoke about at practice as opposed to at training. So would you tell me about how you create that environment at the clubs you go into where people can practice and learn rather than just train to get fit?
Well, as I've gone on probably in more experience, I've started to look to find out what's changing. And part of being my periods where I've been out of work, I've tried to retrain myself a little bit. So I worked for UEFA, for example, and I would go to the games and we were studying, you know, where are the goals getting scored? How are they getting conceded? You know, so things are brought back. But I also found that I see a change in the training of the players now. You know, we train as a group, you know, you're a team. But I see much more individual work. I see much more group work. So I think since I've come back, I've tried to introduce much more group work, individual work, specific on the person or the unit, more unit meetings, less long meetings, possibly trying to be much, much more positive than I'd been in the past, because I felt as if I was going into a job now, I'm saying, I'm fed up being, not negative, but being down on myself, because every game in this business is a hard one to win, you know, and you can hardly smile because you've got another difficult game round the corner. But I just changed my mind and said, I'm going to be positive, I'm going to pass it on to the players, and we're going to try and be attractive as much as we can. We're going to try and get to a stage where we're a much more attractive looking team.
And what have you seen as a difference since you've deliberately tried to be more positive? What impact have you seen that's had?
I think when you're someone who's never always been that way, it's very hard to admit it.
Yeah.
But I think when you do get and you see it, you go, wow, you know, I wish I'd been doing that a lot earlier. But I mean, there's a difference in being completely positive and being completely unrealistic. But I certainly think communication's become really, really big at the football clubs now. Years gone by, nobody would have knocked a manager's door. You know, as a player, I was a player, you'd have tried to stay away from the manager's door. You know, the manager's coming quick, out the way. I actually see it as being the opposite. I think communication, and I think it's the manager who's the, or the head coach, is probably the person who has to now lead the communication, because the players are different, as we've mentioned. There's a different environment. And I see communication being positive, much more needed than maybe it was when I first started management.
You know, what you want is an open and communicative environment where people are able to be vulnerable, right? And say, look, I don't know, or I've made a mistake. Mm-hmm. But that has to come from the leader. Mm-hmm. So have you learned that you need to be vulnerable at the top to allow people below you to be the same? Because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in years gone by, football was not an environment when people were happy to be vulnerable. It was seen as a weakness rather than a strength.
Yeah, that's right. And I see that that my job was to change, just like the players have got to change in many ways as well. And I do think that, I think there's been a big change in the players and how they come over now towards the manager. I think they're much more open. You know, we're working together much more closely. Players are interested in improving and what they can do, whereas in days gone by, you know, as you mentioned, maybe just trying to avoid contact with the manager, only really going to see him for a new contract or, you know, for something else. I think nowadays there's a much more interaction.
Has it changed the way you communicate? And like, do you say to your players, I got that wrong, I messed up?
All the time. I would hope personally I'd done that throughout my career, because I always want to be the first one to say, hey, I didn't get it right here. But quite often, you know, if a defender makes a mistake and he scores a goal, that doesn't mean the manager's got that wrong, you know. It means that the defender's made a mistake. So you wouldn't take responsibility for that, but you take the wholesome responsibility, because you know that ultimately, you know, we're the ones who are going to be judged. And the other thing is, you need the players. You know, they're very much part of what you do. And if you don't have them on your side, you know, it makes your job a lot more difficult.
So you're talking now with years of experience of good and of bad moments. When you look back on your management career, what would you say was the single biggest moment of learning for you, that where you think, wow, that really taught me something?
When I was given the job at Preston North End, I was really fortunate to work with a really good chairman who was very calm, and would phone me on a Sunday evening, 8 o'clock on a Sunday evening. How was the game, David? And what was it? No, he was at the game and spoke about the game. He wasn't a huge, big knowledge of the game. And I found him, and he always was very calm, you know, do things correctly, you know, move on, don't get too high, don't get too low. And I remember, you know, even the things, small things at this time, when I was a really young, up-and-coming coach, you know, he said to me, I'd go to him with, you know, I want to buy a new centre-forward, for example, and I'd say, look, there's one here, he's 29 years old, lots of goals, and it's a 19-year-old here who's, you know, on the way up. And he sort of always said to me, in our situation, always take the young one. And it might sound a really simple thing to say, and you might say, well, does that matter? But I took that philosophy with me to Everton regarding recruitment. And if you look back at the Everton team when I took over at Everton, you know, it was David Ginola, Paul Gascoigne, you know, Tommy Gravison, Duncan Ferguson. I could go on and on about lots of senior players who were top, top players. But I had sort of went to Everton and gave them the eye and said to them when they asked me, I says, look, I'd like to bring in young, hungry players with a different perspective. And we ended up with the likes of Tim Cahill's and, you know, Joel and Lescott's and all the players all through their days, and most of them all went on to become international players. So I there was another way, but that journey was quite a long way. So the information and the advice I got at that time, I think, helped me very much in how I shaped a couple of clubs.
So can I ask you about that period when you took over at Preston? Because I always think it's a real transition of going from a player to being a player manager. And how did you go about creating boundaries with former teammates where to establish your authority?
The story was always that, you know, going from a player to the manager was terrible. That used to be the thing that used to say in the era we went by, that wasn't good. But I had been a player. I had been player coach. I had been assistant manager, and I eventually became manager at Preston North End. And I think by the time I got to the manager, the players, I was still playing at the time. I think the players knew that I was hoping that someday I might be going to coaching or management.
Yeah.
And I don't think the players were that surprised. And the difference I felt is I felt that taking over in that situation, I sort of knew what the players wanted, what they needed. How could I get some small wins when you take over? And I think that helped me an awful lot. I mean, I've got to say, when I first got the job, I didn't really want it because I thought, I'm still playing. You know, they wanted, I remember the Preston supporter, they wanted Ian Rush, or they wanted Joe Royal as manager at the time.
Right.
And it's a bit like all these jobs, you get it, and half the time the people didn't want you. And it's even worse now in the world we're living in just now. So you have to sort of trust yourself in what you've been doing. But I spent an awful lot of my years between 20 and 30 desperately trying to become a better football player. And by doing that, I found myself going on coaching courses, trying to relearn and saying, well, how will this make me better? What will I do? What in turn it probably done was build up my sort of network of people I know, people seeing me out, people seeing that I was really interested in the game. And I think because of that, it helped me in the end when it came down to getting a managerial job.
So how was that curiosity and that willingness to keep evolving and improving yourself, how was that perceived both as a player and then as a coach when you had that sort of innate hunger?
So I just have to say, I had a really good football career. I played 500 games at all different levels. I had a great, great football career. I really enjoyed it. But on that journey, I was still trying to find ways. Like I'd become a full-time Scottish coach when I was 21. And then I went and decided I would do the coaching courses in England as well, even though you don't have to. So I went and done them again. It's a little bit like going to university in Glasgow, then going to do it in London, if you know what I mean, and doing the same courses. But I felt that for me maybe to be recognised in England, then maybe I had to show that I could do the badges in England. But the journeys I went to watch teams training, I wrote to managers, I went to World Cups. And at the time, I have to say, a lot of the stuff I had, I was lucky I got funded by the PFA to go a couple of times when I didn't have the finances to do it. I wrote to clubs and I had some great stories from clubs who who I wrote to, and managers of great names.
Like who?
The best would be Sir Bobby Robson, who was a manager of Barcelona at the time, and I wrote a letter to him asking if I could come out and watch them train. And no reply. And I can't remember what age I'd be, maybe 30, maybe a bit less. And I didn't get anything back for maybe a month. Then he wrote me a personal letter back, handwritten. And it says, I'm really sorry, David. I'm really late in replying. It was at the bottom of the pile and et cetera, et cetera. He says, I'm about to lose my job. He says, and Louis van Gaal's about to become the next manager. So I think I'm going to lose my job here. Wow. So I ended up not getting out to Barcelona. But I believe somewhere in my boxes, in my loft somewhere, I still have the letter from Sir Bobby, which I always see that as... is it taught me a little bit about being a coach and a manager that he had time to write to someone who he would have had no idea about. And also, I feel as if that was the way I always thought I should be then. You know, you have to give people your time. Of course, nowadays, the living we're in nowadays doesn't mean that you can reply to everybody and write a letter to them. But I think trying to be courteous and try to give as much back as you can.
It's very interesting hearing about that real drive to become a coach from a relatively young age, you know, and you had a brilliant playing career. Many players would have gone, done well, mm-hmm. had a good career, that'll be enough. But there was this real clear sort of burning desire, and Preston went well. I mean, what you created at Everton still gets talked about today, the journey you took that club on. And then obviously came that big move to Manchester United. How hard was it to go through that experience at Manchester United? Almost the first real sort of difficult spell as a manager after all those years of desire. Because when that call comes in, you think, wow, this is the moment, don't you?
Yeah. I've got some great thoughts about Manchester United, really have. But, you know, at that time I had met probably three other of the top clubs, either in England or in Europe, who wanted me to become the manager. And my mind was that I wasn't leaving Everton. It was only Sir Alex which made the difference, because Sir Alex wanted me to become manager and as I've said many times, you know, he was the one who personally said, you know, you're the next manager of Manchester United. But that came very, very late at the end of the season, and you know, and I was disappointed that I couldn't sort of deal with it better. With Bill Kenwright at the time, because I was really close to Bill Kenwright at that time. But Manchester United was special club. I think I wish I was probably where I maybe am now, maybe 7-8 years older, because I even think at that time I felt experienced, and maybe at that time was experienced. And if you look at the history of Manchester United, they always tended to... They never really always took what they saw as being the top manager. They took something which fitted their model.
Yep.
Sir Alex fitted their model from Aberdeen, had been very successful at Aberdeen, fitted their model, you know, going to give young players the chance, you know, develop their own players, didn't always buy the most expensive players on the planet. And that's what sort of I look forward to, because I saw them as seeing me as someone who they could see who would develop the club and play young players and... you know, put effort into coaching and all the things that would come from it. But unfortunately, it didn't quite go that way, and I only had 10 months. But I see it still as a real positive for many reasons. I don't think many people got offered a Manchester United job.
Picking up on what you said there, David, that if you were offered that job now, 7 or 8 years older, what would you have done now that you didn't do then?
Strange enough, everybody said to me, you know, things which maybe have changed. If there was anything I wanted to do, I didn't want to change anything about what I'd done with Sir Alex. But this is interesting, because I have a couple of people I speak to. I had one guy who's a top manager said to me, you have to take your own team. I had somebody else said to me, no, you have to keep what's there. So it's really quite subjective when you get to these decision making, and you know, who would to say who's right or who's wrong about your own personal team and the people you bring in. But my idea was to follow on everything Sir Alex done. Obviously, I wouldn't be the same. Of course, he was a legend in how he worked and what he done. But I hoped that I wasn't going to change too much. Maybe in hindsight, maybe I had to change maybe quickly. But I think everybody could see it's probably going to, it has taken, and it's probably going to take a bit of time to get it back to those levels again.
Do you feel that the criticism, that the cultural memory of some of those people that Sir Alex had there with him, that moved on when he moved on, do you feel that that was a loss that wasn't properly acknowledged?
I felt that keeping at least one or two of Alex's staff would have been really important, which I did try to do. In the end, it didn't quite work that way. But I tried to add Ryan Giggs to it. I brought Phil Neville, people who had experience. But I take the point. I think me getting into Manchester United, if I could fix it and go back, I'd probably say, well, I needed Rennie Moore Neilston to stay, or I needed Mickey Phelan to stay, which I've admitted and said that, you know, if I got that opportunity again, that's what I would do.
Right.
But again, when you've had, I wouldn't say big success, but when you've built 10 or 11 years of people who've worked around you with your own staff, people who are loyal to you and people know how you work, you know, you want to be loyal back to them as well. And that's probably part of me. I'm a pretty loyal person.
Tell us, if you can, what your first experience was like of that elite Manchester United dressing room, because Preston were professional. Everton, you achieved amazing things, but, you know, this is a Manchester United team that had been on the back of this amazing period under Sir Alex.
They were unbelievable. It's a bit like where we are today, and I only use it as a sort of an example. It's as if when you're at the club, you can look over the top of everybody else like we are from this building here today. Their mentality to win, their drive, their hunger was something which I hadn't seen. And I've got to say, I had a really good group of players. In fact, I had a fantastic group of players at Everton. But I saw something more, something which was connected to being a winner, connected to maybe ego a little bit as well. We are going to show that, you know, what we are. So I saw a lot of that, which was good for me, because I said, it felt as if you were looking out the penthouse window and you had a chance to see how good it really looked.
Did you not feel that you were at home there, given like what you've said about your own hunger to win and your desire to improve? Did it not feel that you were amongst kindred spirits?
I did. I thought, you know, ideally, you know, there's lots of things. I had great support from Sir Alex, great support from David Gill in the background as well, who had both left the club. You know, I had met quite a lot of the former players privately and sort of spoke to them and know whether about them coming back in or whether it'd been involved in jobs or whatever. I think everybody knew that Sir Alex would go at some time, and obviously somebody was going to have to take the job. And actually, I felt as if people were really, really supportive. They really did. It was only maybe a year or so later, and I'm a big part of the League Managers Association, and I'm on the board, and it was Howard Wilkinson who actually said, if you actually look back at the football clubs which have had the dynasties, you know, like Don Revie, even Sir Bobby, the people, or Brian Clough, the people who followed them, none of them have really been that successful. And I said, you wish you'd told me that earlier, but I still don't feel as if it would have made me change any of my views. I saw getting the Manchester United job is a real big thing that I wanted to try. And I saw, the main reason I saw for doing it was winning trophies, because I thought Everton's a great club and I would be knocking at the door for 10 or 11 years, struggling to win a trophy. Good, I want to go to Manchester United and win trophies.
During that period then, when did you sort of come to the realisation that it wasn't going to work, or that there wasn't the buy-in?
I probably never thought at any time it wasn't going to work. And I'll tell you the reason why is because the owners had so much grief in their time there. They would stick by their manager. You know, they had done it. Even Sir Alex in times had done it. And even the Glazers, you know, had a really tough time. And so I had real belief that, you know, no matter what would happen, they would stick by me and see it through. So in Manchester United's style was not to, you know, change their managers regular, to do things correctly, give everybody time. So I was surprised, but ultimately when I look back, you know, I shouldn't be surprised, because winning games at Manchester United and being up near the top's the thing that matters.
Could you share with us how it works in that situation? It sounds like you're a guy who didn't necessarily see it coming. So what is there, a phone call? Is it a meeting? When does that moment sort of arise? What goes on? Yeah,
well, I believe that as if you're a leader, I think giving bad news should be done with dignity.
Yeah.
Whatever line of work, your business, MD's business, you know, there'll be things in life where we all have to give bad news, but I think there's a style you should do it in, and I think you should try and do it. And I think when you're the biggest sports, or one of the biggest sports industries in the world, I think that, you know, you should have people who know how to do that. And I just felt in the end it didn't end very well.
How did they do it then?
Well, it was done by a come into the office early in the morning and meet. But by the time it got round, like a lot of these situations is, the media had got hold of it, which is the norm, and it can happen. I think that's the world we're in. But hey, I hold no grudges whatsoever now. I'm well moved on, and as I said, it's in the past, and I like going back to Old Trafford. I do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the supporters don't probably see me as bad a light as maybe some do. I think they probably understand exactly how difficult it was.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I just want to talk to you very briefly about what I believe to be a total revolution in sleep, and it's called 8Sleep. It's a pod cover that goes on the mattress that's currently on your bed, and it controls the temperature to suit you perfectly. And it all works from this app. Me and my wife, we like different temperatures. I actually like my side of the bed cooler. But the 8Sleep isn't just about the temperature. It's your own personal sleep coach. I get a sleep fitness score. I can find out more about the quality of my sleep, the kind of routine that I'm in. But it also gives me the different sleep stages as well, so I can find out how much REM sleep or deep sleep I'm getting. And then I can tailor things in my own life, like alcohol or coffee before bed or when I work out, to try and improve my sleep. And we all know that sleep is the foundation of high performance. If we can improve our sleep, we can improve so much of our life. It's time to bring tech to the bedroom by going to 8sleep.com/HPP, where you can get £200 off your pod and free shipping. That's 8sleep.com/HPP.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience-based, and what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
And then comes the moment for the first time in your career where it's like, right, okay, I've lost the job. Now I need to reset. Can you talk us through the process that you went through, not just to get back into the game, but to sort of learn the lessons, mentally reset, and be ready to go back into, you know, what it really is, a sort of lion's den, isn't it, of football management?
Yeah, I think I had quite a few offers to go. And part of when I mentioned I'd been in the LMA, you know, there was no, one of the reasons I was part of the board was because I felt that there's no British managers are getting opportunities to work in England. You know, if you look at our league, even our lower leagues now. So the chance to work in Spain or Italy or Germany, the big leagues, there was no British managers. Gary Neville had gone to Valencia. But if you look back over the years, Howard Kendall, Sir Bobby, Terry Venables, no, there's others, but probably not many had been getting the jobs in, in those countries. So I got offered a job in Spain, which I have to say was a brilliant job, in a great experience. And when you talk about culture and learning and stuff like that, you know, it was a brilliant experience to understand Spanish players, how they react, you know, seeing them.
I'd love you to explain to us the difference, how, you know, the real tangible differences between the
tangible
two.
Difference is the players I had in the Basque region were fantastic. And they tell me the ones up in that region are more, I would use the word British in a term. So we had really, really good players. Really, their attitudes was fantastic. We didn't have a minute's problem with any of them. What we did have a problem with is that the culture at the club I was at, Real Sociedad, was that we had to have 18 out of a squad of 25 had to be from the academy. Now, if you actually think about saying, well, okay, Manchester United have to have 18 boys out of the academy, or Chelsea, or Man City, it would be a completely different world.
Yeah.
You're not winning. It was, as a manager going in, one who's saying, well, I'm coming out here to repair maybe damage that had been done, first British manager out in one of the big leagues for a long time. And I understood it when I went in, but I didn't really understand it till I got there.
Why did Sociedad have that policy? Was it just
their region, it's their identity, it's their culture.
Right.
They want the players to come through their own academy. Now, you could go to Atletico Bilbao, who are all pure Basque, so they only will sign Basque players from that region. So sometimes you look at it and you say, well, you know, it's an incredible how well Real Sociedad are doing just now, and even Atletico Bilbao, what they've got. But it became a period where if you had a good cycle of the young players, you'd be, it's good,
comes,
you know.
Comes back to luck again.
It comes back to being in the right place and a little bit of luck and good fortune. You need all that in to be a successful manager. But I've got to say, the culture, the living, I thought, you know, the way the players trained, the way the players eat, which I thought was different to what I see here. I saw a different mentality to it. So there was things like
that.
What was
different with the mentality?
Well, the mentality, I saw players who were very professional, no days off, maybe one day off a week, you know, probably play, recover, maybe have a day off and then back into it. Whereas, you know, there was a British cycle of it, and it's changed greatly now where, you know, we might have had a Sunday off and a Wednesday off, and I see that changing as well now, partly because of, you know, different nationalities which are coming into our league here just now. But in Spain, I didn't see, there was very little time off, weren't looking for much time off. You know, it was interesting, they would train any time, the Spanish boys, except probably lunch, where lunch in Spain was incredibly important to them, sort of between 2 and 4. You know, want to train before, want to train after, not a problem. So small things I saw were interesting. The games I found really enjoyable. You know, I've got great memories of beating Barcelona 1-0 as the manager of Real Sociedad. So I had a really good time, and partly due to going out there was partly because it was something I wanted to take on and wanted to try and change the trend of overseas managers only coming to this country.
So would you tell us about the power of a collective purpose then? Because when you're describing the Sociedad experience, I see some parallels with when you went into Everton and you coined that phrase about the people's club, and you sort of got people gathered and moving in the same direction. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there was a potential to do that at Sociedad as well. You representing a region. Yeah. Would you tell us about what that gives you as a manager, how you can plug into that?
Well, I think interesting, where the Basques in that area were really keen on, because I was from Scotland, they were so keen on independence, you know, so they were mad keen. They were more interested. Do you want independence? No, we want independence. So there was a political issue to that region was really important. You know, they saw their own independence being really important, which you had to understand. But I felt that if I take you back to where I went to Everton, no, the People's Club was just, I wish I'd thought it up for days and brought up a great saying. It wasn't. It was a spur of the moment. Driving in and thinking, I saw the kids out in the street with strips on and Everton strips on, and I thought, oh, they'll call this the People's Club. And at that time, it was really big. Sometimes folk think that football managers, we're all you know, professors in education and in English literature and all these words and everything else. You've got to remember, we, most of us are been football players all our life, not been at school as long as we should have been probably, and more interested in football than we were education. So we're not trained PR experts or people who can conduct podcasts like this. We're sort of football people who want to do that. But the People's Club for me was a big moment, because suddenly the supporters felt maybe there's somebody here going to try and move us. And you've got to remember that city has been predominantly dominated by Liverpool.
Yeah.
And the club there is desperately in need of trying to challenge more often.
Yeah, but because it seemed to tap into something quite deep, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And why you say that is, you know, I called it the People's Club, and we got a poster sent in from a Liverpool supporter of the village people, you know, and it had a picture of Duncan Ferguson and me and Tommy Gravison and all the players with the village people. And, you know, you could see that it sort of stirred a few people at that time. It had a little bit. But the humour in that city, as you can imagine by that, is tremendous.
I think it's so interesting having this type of a conversation with a current manager, which doesn't happen often enough, because the job is so multifaceted, isn't it? And everyone sort of sees football through their own lens. You know, you've just had the situation with Kurt Zouma, where you made the decision to keep him in, and some people thought that shouldn't have been the case, and others within the club, I'm sure, thought it was the right decision, because your job is to try and win games of football. Do you think that we expect too much sometimes of managers? We expect them to be PR experts. We expect them to be great managers of people. We expect them to be able to win games of football and bring the fans on side and manage up to the chairman and look at a great 16-year-old and work out whether they're good enough or not. It seems almost the impossible job in that respect.
Yeah, I think in many cases we've got some brilliant role models of managers. You know, we mentioned Sir Alex earlier on. We mentioned Sir Bobby Robson. You know, there's so many who would fit the bill, but we're not sometimes educated enough to deal with the situation which comes very quickly. For example, you know, the Kurt Zouma thing came on us very, very quickly. You know, maybe given more time, there could have been a change of how we'd thought, but it came on very quickly. Some of the situations you get put in as a manager, like that situation, was one which I hope never comes up again. And all you can do is deal with it the best you possibly can. And I think the most important thing then is tell the truth and be exactly trustworthy.
Trustworthy. That's a good point, though, because I think that we say a lot on this podcast that in this modern world, there's an awful lot of opinion and there's not a lot of empathy. Do you find, as a football manager, people don't make enough effort to understand the challenges of the job?
Well, I think we are all often sort of looked at because of the position we have to make the decisions and how do we make them. But quite often, you know, you talk about leadership then, and we mentioned that, you know, you need good leadership, you need good support, you know, you need people, good people around you who can help you and give you great advice. And I just go back to that only because, I mean, the people I had at Everton, and I had Sir Philip Carter, and I told you about, I had Brian Gray, who was my chairman and sort of the owner at the time, or at Preston. Having really good people who you can rely on and say, hey, I've got a problem. You know, being a football manager, we need people to speak to as well. We need people who we can trust, people who can give us some sound advice. So even with all the experience we've got, and I have to say, you know, I used to phone Walter Smith. And in the early days when I was a bit younger and I didn't quite have the connection with Sir Alex, I would phone Sir Alex for advice on, you know, should I take a job? You know, Walter Smith. Sadly, I phoned Walter Smith maybe 2-3 weeks before he died and passed away, and he was fantastic. You know, he was talking about the team, you know, what we should do, you know, what it looked like. So even in the position we're in, no, we need a little bit of help. None of us are above that.
Out of all those legendary figures that you've spoken to, what has been the best piece of advice they've given you that you still hold true today?
I couldn't say the words what Walter said to me. but... You know, even recent incidents, you know, the support I've had from some of those managers has been incredible. You know, people who see it and understand the business and understand you're put in a situation about making decisions, you know, And there's a lot of opinions out there. You know, the industry, the world, these situations means a lot of opinions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you have to try and do it with a bit of humility. You're trying to tell people how things are, you know, but I'm not trying to tell them this is the way. But somewhere along the line, you have to be the person who makes the decision.
How do you tune out all these opinions then? You know, like it's that old saying, opinions are like arseholes, aren't they? Everyone's got one. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't do social media, so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think I'd like to be part of it, but partly frightened by it because I think that, you know, staying away from it, I think it's a safer bet. I've never known it, so why go into something which I don't really know? But I think sometimes you'd like to put your own opinions out and maybe say things which, you know, I hope would be helpful or be good. But over the years, when you think back to in the early days when I go back to Press and North End, what you used to get was a letters page on a Thursday in the newspaper in the Preston Evening Post, and there would be six or seven letters. Why is David Moyes picking this team? What's he doing this? And you would be raging. And you know, you'd be saying, who's doing this? It's terrible. And at that time, and it's a strange thing, is criticism affects everybody. It affects people's mental health, you know, and it becomes a situation where you look and say, I see many TV shows, I see many radio shows quite regularly talking about there's a man going to lose his job. What do you think? Phone in. Ask about what you think. Do you think this man should lose his job? But yet that seems okay for television broadcasters or for radio broadcasters to do, yeah, as if that's part of the job. And actually, when you think about it, it's a really damaging situation that these people put the managers in.
So if there was one opinion that you'd want people to know that you have to share, what would that be?
Opinion?
Because you don't use it, these platforms to share it. What would you?
I think that possibly, you know, the Manchester United period, will always be one. I see it as a big miss for me. I missed a great chance. I don't see it as a negative. I see me having a chance to do it, and I wasn't ready, or I didn't do something right. So that would be my opinion on where I got it. I got the chance, and I didn't quite take it. So. I look back with regret and wishing that I'd done a better job.
But what's nice is we can sit here and we can see all of the positives from all of these moments. And I think sometimes when it comes to management particularly, we say, oh, well, he's lost a couple of jobs, so is he the right man for that job? Look at what you've learned from the experience at Manchester United or at Sociedad. Look how you can marry that up with coming through the ranks at Preston or building that amazing ethos at Everton. And now, in the West Ham dugout, it's not a coincidence that suddenly you've created one of the best teams of your management career and a real momentum at a club that, let's be honest, for a long time was a, you know, a listing ship.
Yeah. The closest I could put it to is I feel as if there's a chance that West Ham could be built into something really special. I think that because of the period at Everton. Mm. I saw the journey at Everton, and I don't think any of us nowadays would be ever see any managers doing 10 and 11 years. Well, I've done 11 and a half years. I don't think there's many people who do that, even Pep or Jurgen or maybe Dyche might, who knows. But overall, I think to be on that journey is really hard. But I see West Ham having such potential. I see a chance to change how it's seen, perceived. I want to do it on the pitch first and foremost, because if we get that, we'll get the support behind us. I see a different atmosphere in the West Ham stadium than there's been before. I see younger supporters. I see a stadium now, yeah, which is not everybody's favourite and might never be that. But I see it being somewhere where you can get young supporters coming to the games in the East End of London, where there's not a great deal of money and they can get in relatively cheap to see Premier League players and see Premier League matches, which... And nowadays is such a big thing, you know, as people travel all around the world to see Premier League matches. So West Ham do an awful lot of good stuff in trying to make it a bit affordable for young people.
Great.
We were lucky enough to get Phil Neville on this podcast series, who spoke really glowingly about his time working with you at Everton. And he spoke very much around this idea of cultural architects, the leaders in the dressing room, mm-hmm, that set the tone, set the standard. Yeah. He spoke about coming in and doing his extras before anyone else. Yeah. What are you looking for in that dressing room at West Ham now in terms of those characteristics that can help you be successful?
Well, Phil Neville was one of the catalysts to what we had. And when we brought Phil from Manchester United, all the traits, what I saw there, Phil had brought in. He took responsibility like you couldn't believe. And I tell a story about, and I still do when I'm out, you know, where one of the players was getting booed by the crowd, not performing well, chanting, get him off, whatever it might have been at the time. And I remember Phil Neville coming in at half-time and going mad with the players and said, look, if they're booing him and shouting against them, they're booing us all. And I thought he took responsibility all the time, kept taking the ball, kept wanting the ball, and wouldn't let it happen to one player. And he was one of the first I saw, you know, the leadership groups, you know, within the players, you know, making sure at that time. Now, you can back a little bit more where there wasn't quite as much as there is maybe today in these situations, but Phil was great at making sure that checking the players, how are they, you know, what was going on. So he showed me something else, Phil, coming from, and I think he took it from Manchester United. But at our club at the moment, Mark Noble's an incredible leader, and he has been in sort of taking the club through. If you look at the periods that West Ham have been through and the things that have been going on, and Mark's sort of been the one who's stood fast, made sure that things go on, and he still is today. He works really hard for the team, but he's great for me behind the scenes, and he's training up Declan Rice. He's, you know, he's letting other young players see how it is. He's doing quite a bit with, he watches the academy games and sees a lot of the 23s, and he's always sort of in their ears that, no, you're not getting the first team if you're going to behave that way. You'll if you don't do it right, then you'll not do it. So it's great to have people around you like that. So yeah. Mark Noble's one of them, I've got to say.
Great.
And how many of them do you think you need in a dressing room, like characters like that, for it to really start to take hold and become the standards?
I think you need 2, 3. I think sometimes if you can have more than that, that can become a bit of an issue, because you can have, you know, real sort of, I wouldn't say, you know, you can have real challenges every week with it. But I think that having a few in the dressing room is a big thing. And as modern football's going now, where we're not communicating very well, you know, we're communicating through our phones, even though I talk about communication as a manager earlier on, I think the communication between players and on the pitch, you know, we talk about players used to shout, you know, get stuck in it, my man on, or, you know, the shout. I see it less. Partly language might be a bit to do with it. We've got much more overseas players. Mm. Partly maybe it's one of the aspects of the game which you think of the improvements we have in football, know how we see how well Pep coaches his players and how well they play in Jurgen and their intensity. But, you know, when it comes to communication on the field, I would say it's probably one of the things which has dropped off a little.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you very much for communicating with us. It's lovely to sit here and talk like this, because it's clear that your drive and your passion for management and football remains as strong as ever. We've got a few really fast, quick-fire questions for you.
This will be the problem, because the brain needs to start working quickly, doesn't it?
So yeah. The first one is, what are the 3 non-negotiables that you and the people around you should buy into?
3 non-negotiables is discipline, commitment, probably attitude.
Love it.
If you could go back to one moment in your life, what would it be and why?
I'd go back to when I was a young player at Celtic. I played with some of the best Scottish players, played for an unbelievable football club. And I think I'd love to go back. I played some games, won a Premier League medal at Celtic when I was young. But I think if I could, had a chance to do it again and say, oh boy, what a chance. And I always wanted to become a full Scottish international, which I wasn't, so.
And finally, for all those people that have listened to this conversation, I'm sure there'll be many Everton, Man United, West Ham, Celtic, Preston fans among them. As you sit here now with all your experiences, and we've relived a lot of them over the last hour or so, what would you say now is your one golden rule to living a high-performance life?
My energy and my love of football. I think if you don't love football, then I think you find it very hard to have a longevity in it. I think you see so many good older managers who are still in the game now, but it's the love of the game. And I think the minute you lose the energy, you know, I love watching live football. I like going out to see it. I like the amount of games I've been to and I've seen, oh, I've seen a player tonight. Or, you know, it's changed a little bit because we have so much on television. But it was always a way that I wanted to go and see live football because I felt that was the best way to learn maybe a new corner kick routine, maybe a new tactic. And I still, in my own way, want to hope that that's still the way you can continue to learn.
Brilliant.
Love that.
Thank you very much. Damien.
Jake.
David is a hugely successful football manager and he's someone who spends his life giving feedback. I think what was really interesting in that conversation is he's clearly learned from taking feedback as well.
Yeah, that message that he said about learning to be a little bit more optimistic, maybe be happier, to smile more, might sound trite on the surface, but actually, you know, a leader is somebody that needs to project a certain image, a certain level of confidence. And I think we've all seen managers looking beleaguered or stressed on the touchline and the impact that has on their team and the wider community, such as the supporters, is significant. So I thought that was really honest and open of him to share that.
And when are we going to change this weird conversation around football management? Because I know there'll be people listening to this now that go, David Moyes, high performance, but he lost his job at Man United and he struggled a bit at Real Sociedad. Like, when are we going to realise that those are the very things that take you towards high performance? Because those are the failures, those are the struggles. Therefore, those are the periods of learning. Like, he's a better high performer for those difficult times.
I was involved many years ago with the England Rugby League team when we went out to Australia in the World Cup and performed pretty mediocrely. But I remember speaking to the coaches afterwards and knowing that every one of those coaches involved in that was richer and better for that experience. And whilst it's horrible in the moment, like he admitted his Manchester United experience was, it can only be better because he's done the reflection, he's acquired the hard yards of experience that meant that no doubt he is a more rounded, better leader today than he was 10 years ago.
But that's why he's taken West Ham as far as he has in Europe. But that's why they're pushing to be in Europe again next season. And you know, that's why he's able to come on this podcast and share really eloquently with us the learnings and the lessons. And, you know, even when we spoke there about the Kurt Zouma situation, and if you watch this on YouTube, you'll see, you know, he looks like he doesn't like talking about it because I think he's probably embarrassed about it. And I think that even that is a learning experience. If something happens, as he said, at West Ham in the future and they have to make an instant decision, it will be a different instant decision from the one that they took this time around, which they will be the first to acknowledge wasn't right.
Yeah. I think the beauty of this podcast, Jake, is that we get beyond the cartoon image of just somebody being good or bad or fantastic or rubbish. And you see the human side of it. You see the struggles, you see the difficulties, you see the ambiguity that so many of us are having to deal with. And I think that's a really good example of it, that it's easy just to give a headline response to that situation without understanding the human element that sits behind it.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Thank you, mate. Loved it.
Well, once again, it's that time of High Performance where we welcome a listener to join us. And normally I would introduce them, but I think that should be your honour, Damien, because you and our guest today, you know each other, right?
Yeah, we do. So we've got daughters in the same class at school. And we were talking in the playground recently where Louisa told me about this brilliant, phenomenal charity that she's involved in that makes a real difference. So, Louisa, thank you for coming on. Would you tell us a little bit more around the charity?
I would, yeah. Thank you for having me, though. So I am a personal stylist whereby I clear out ladies' wardrobes, recreate outfits for them, personal shopping, all that kind of thing. And I donate all the stuff after each session to a local community centre, which is also a food bank, and they do a lot of work for the community. And the fabulous woman there, she's called Kirsty Taylor at the Biddeford Centre, asked, do I ever get prom dresses and anything like that? And I do get prom dresses, shoes, handbags. We spoke about why, and they have a lot of families within the area whose teenagers say, proms aren't for them, they're not into it, they're too cool for it, it's not their thing, when actually the true matter is they can't afford it because, as we all know, prom outfits, especially the extra pressure for girls to get the hair, the makeup, can spiral into the hundreds. And there's a lot of comparison with each other, who's wearing what, that kind of thing. So our initiative is called DressOS, and we are creating a charity whereby they don't need to worry about that. The cost of living obviously is real and it's happening. And if you can't afford to feed your family, you're certainly not going to spend, £150 on a dress. So the idea is that they can come to us, choose the dress, choose the suit for the boys, the shoes. We're going to try and get some hairdressers, makeup artists on board, so they feel like it's a real event for them, and it's not that they're getting something donated to them. So just for them to get the experience that other teenagers and young adults would get, that they shouldn't have to miss out on.
I think that is brilliant. I really love what you're doing, Louisa, because I think, you know, all of us on this conversation are parents, and we can let ourselves down sometimes and get over it, but feeling like you're letting your children down is sort of the most painful thing ever. And I know you listen to the podcast. What kind of inspiration has High Performance given you when it comes to this venture?
I mean, I suppose the one that we're most aligned with is the Mary Portas episode. So, you know, with the sad passing of her family when she was a teenager, her mother at 16 and her father at 18, she knows the pressure that is on teenagers, and the pressure that they have now is even more so with social media, all that kind of thing that wasn't around them. But the fact that Mary Portas talked about collaboration and generosity and kindness. So the community centre that I'm working with there are brilliant, and they do so much hard work for the entire community. And, you know, my fashion styling career is doing well, but sometimes it can seem a bit vacuous and people say, what is actually a personal stylist? What do they do? So it's about working together as a team. And I think the other side of things, which Mary Portas speaks about brilliantly as well, is the sustainability side of things. So teenagers should not feel embarrassed that they're wearing something that's pre-loved, because it's the most important way that we can keep the fashion world turning. And, you know, people are going to buy new things and they're going to want new things, and that's human nature. But it's about being mindful with how you spend your money and what you spend your money on, and turning away from fast fashion, but thinking about things. So do I need it and do I love it? And that's fine. That's one separate thing. But the fact that if you're going to spend £150 or, you know, in some cases £300 or more, and you're going to wear it once, let's pass that on. And, you know, these dresses are absolutely perfect. There's nothing wrong with them. So why spend money on something when there's no better way to keep this, you know, the eco styling of it all going. So that's another aspect that we want the teenagers to be actually really proud of. Yes, they may not be able to necessarily afford it, but they don't have shame in the fact that they've got a donated dress or a dress that they may borrow from us and pass on to somebody else, because that's the way forward for these teens, and they're so much more climate aware now.
And what does it do for them as people as well, Louisa, this ability for these kids from more difficult backgrounds to be able to go to a prom?
Well, you know, especially the last 2 years with COVID, teenagers have been hit so hard. And what we find is, especially at the food bank, the food hub, is unfortunately we have families with very young kids, and that's devastating. And also devastating the fact that they don't know any different. So younger kids, primary school kids, think that's the norm, whereas the teenagers don't. They have that extra shame of it. And we want to take that away from them and give them the opportunity that all the other kids have, who may be in the same school but come from a different locality. But giving them that chance and giving them that opportunity to feel confident, to feel proud, and to really celebrate the fact that they've spent however many years at school working really hard. And it's a monumental event for teenagers, and it's only getting bigger. And why should they miss out because of the unfortunate position that they're in?
It's brilliant. Listen, Louisa, thanks for listening to the podcast. Thanks for doing what you're doing. And I wish you all the luck in the world with it.
Thank you very much, Jake.
So where can people find out more about the charity then, Louisa?
They can find my details on Instagram, which is Louisa, L-U-I-S-A-G, stylist. We have a Facebook page called DressOS, and we also have a website, dressos.co.uk. We built it ourselves. We're a very small team of a few people, so please excuse it. We're not very IT savvy, so it's all quite basic. But you can get in touch with us that way or over email, hello@dressos.co.uk.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much. You know what I really hope is that you get in touch with us. I love it when we release an episode like this and we get messages from you. So please hop onto my Instagram right now. You'll find me at Jake Humphrey. Damien is at Liquid Thinker. You can find the podcast as well at High Performance. But please just ping us a note. Tell us what you made of it, what you thought, what you liked, what you didn't like. Don't forget, we're not telling you what to think. We're just putting these people in front of you and we're asking you to suspend your opinion, to open your minds and maybe have your mind changed. So let me know what you made of that conversation with David Moyes. And I just want to point you towards something, because high performance for us has always been about impact, impacting as many lives as possible. And it's lovely that so many people are listening and sharing and talking about this podcast. But the younger we can get hold of people and help them with their mindset, then the more of an impact we can have on their lives. So I'd love you to check out our education assets. All you need to do is go to thehighperformancepodcast.com, thehighperformancepodcast.com. If you click on the tab on the top right, you'll see loads of stuff there, whether it's our shop or our live ticket events and all these bits and pieces. But I want you to click on education and just have a look at the kind of stuff that is on offer there for you. And if you want it, you can use it. It's there for you. It's totally free, just like this podcast. We just want to have an impact. We just want to change minds. We just want to change lives. Don't forget, you can also watch all our interviews on YouTube. But for now, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm hugely appreciative. I know Professor Damien Hughes feels exactly the same. The whole team of Gemma and Will and Hannah and Eve and Finn from Rethink Audio, everybody that works on this podcast loves it when you come and listen. Remember, there is no secret. It is all there for you. Be your own biggest cheerleader and make world-class basics your calling card. We'll see you next week.